Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's May 25, 2014. Welcome to episode 75 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and just the general madness of looking at what went by for computers in the history. Good morning, I'm Michael Mulhern and I'm your host for today's episode, and we have a very round table with us today. Hi Carrington, how are you?
I'm excellent.
And Earl?
Happy to be at the pentagonal table.
Ooh.
Big words from Earl.
Paul, do you have any big words as well?
Nope.
Okay.
Oh, come on. He's a professor. He knows lots of big words.
Spread it out. No.
And welcome to Steve.
Hello.
How are you, Steve?
I'm doing great. Back here in Omaha, Nebraska.
Excellent. So we've got the whole gang here. This is excellent.
Is this the first time? I couldn't remember if this is the first time we had all five of us.
I think it is.
It might be. I think it is.
So awesome.
Everyone get ready for a 3-hour show.
Yeah, settle down, put on your seatbelts, and enjoy
with
the
so
flight.
Many around the table, I think the table's actually going to implode. Okay, well, while we've got everyone here, I was just thinking the other day, how far has anyone actually gone to pick up one of their retro purchases or acquisitions? I myself have only sort of traveled out locally, maybe a 200 kilometer round trip to pick up a computer, but no long treks or anything along those lines. And I was just wondering, guys, what is the longest journey that you've made to pick up an acquisition? Carrington, I'm sure you've got some interesting stories.
Well, I've got at least one because I remember blogging about it ages and ages and ages ago back in my old blog, which I haven't updated. So back in, I think it's 2004, I drove to Philadelphia and back to pick up an Apple II. An Apple II got advertised and for giveaway. Somebody just wanted to get rid of it. They said, if nobody will take it, I'm going to chuck it in the trash. I thought, well, we can't have that happen. And at the time, I didn't have an Apple II. So the computer that got me back into vintage computing was that one. So, and that's about 1,800 kilometers round trip. And I just did it straight there, straight back. Basically, it was like a 30-hour trip and just wound my way down without a map. And so like when I take long road trips, I have a habit of bringing an inflatable globe with me. And so it indicates the states. So I'll know roughly where I am. So if I'm totally lost, I can blow it up and go, okay, I want to go up one and over two. Got it. And so that's how it, often things will take a long time. So, you know, Philadelphia and back stops being a one-day trip and instead becomes, you know, 2.5 days or something or however long it took me. So it was super fun. And it's the trip on which I got lost. I went in a corn maze. I went to there's a museum for Harry Houdini that I stumbled on. I went in there and they're not don't allow photography, but I took a bunch of secret photos anyway, thinking Harry would approve. And they did this magic act in there with two of us in the audience because it was a weekday and it was super 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 fun. So yeah, so that was the longest I've ever been is about 800 kilometers round trip to pick up an Apple II.
So it was free except for the petrol.
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
Well, Earl, over in Portland, what's the furthest that you've gone to pick up a retro acquisition?
I've only done things locally, as it turns out. Now, things have been shipped to me from all over the world, probably the farthest being the Spectrums that were shipped to me from the UK. But I wonder if it counts if I just talk about overall mileage, because when the gentleman who gave away the PDP-11 listed it locally here on Craigslist to come pick up for free, I went to go pick it up. But as it turns out, it's a lot of stuff, and I probably made 5 or 6 trips. So I don't know, maybe I traveled 1,800 kilometers to pick up that sucker, even though it was still here in Portland. I've a couple of times been tempted to do a road trip to Seattle because there's the Seattle Retro Computing Society up there, and from time to time, something will come across on their mailing list that sounds really tasty. So a couple times I've been tempted to do that, but I haven't done it yet. So no fun stories from me.
Well, I think multiple loads like that, each one must have been feeling a lot heavier than the previous ones.
Oh my gosh, yes. Luckily my son helped me out, and he's got the scars to prove it. And getting the PDP cabinet down the stairs into our daylight basement, that felt like miles and miles, even though it was only a few meters.
What's the dimensions of that cabinet?
It's about the size of a small refrigerator, and it weighs about as much as a dump truck.
Empty or full?
Does it matter?
Yeah, probably not.
Yes, the size of a small refrigerator and the weight of a large filled refrigerator.
So if we're going to use refrigerators as a standard unit of measurement, then its size is 1. Got it. Okay. How big was it? It was 1.
And that is a NIST-approved unit of measurement, so...
So, utilizing the agreed units of measurement, Steve, what's the furthest that you've traveled to pick up a acquisition?
Answer in refrigerators.
Well, my oldest acquisition was a TRS-80 Model 100 back in like 1994, but that was something somebody on Genie sold to me, so he just mailed it to me. As far as traveling, it would be going to Kansas Fest, and by the way, just happening to bring home some stuff I got there. I didn't actually go anywhere with the purpose of picking up things. Most of my collection is intellectual property, like books and articles and, magazine clippings and things like that. So,
it is pretty easy, though, to wind up picking up stuff at Kansas Fest.
Oh, yes, it is.
It's hard not to. Things will just get thrust upon you. Bring empty bag space when you go there.
And because of Kansas Fest, I have a complete Apple IIe system with disk drives and a monitor that I didn't have before I got there. So, it took a couple years to put it all together, but at least I have one now.
No, that sounds like the way to go. Yeah, I was at a local computer convention last year with no intentions of getting anything, and it literally was a case of people just... thrusting computer cards and bits and pieces and sort of having to figure out, now how am I going to get this back into the luggage?
What? Well, you hate to see stuff get thrown away. Oh, I'm going to toss out if you don't take it. Well, I'll take it.
Yeah.
Yeah, take this or the computer gets it.
If they're angrily thrusting computer cards at you, they might not be trying to give them to you, Michael. I think you got to maybe read the expressions of the people depending on how they're thrusting these things at you.
You mean if they actually let go?
You mean like velocity, that kind of thing.
Whether it's one or two refrigerators in size. No, I even made a passing comment that I was having trouble with my Apple joystick, and one of the guys there said, "Oh, it's that batch of buttons in there. Do you know how to use a soldering iron?" I said, "Yes." And he says, "I just happen to have some spare buttons here. So just give me a tick and I'll get them for you. So thank you, John." So I'm still yet to get those into the joystick, but they're there waiting. That's just another project on the giant list of things to do. So, Paul, we know that you've been getting lots of different toys lately, but what's the furthest that you've traveled to pick something up?
Well, let's see. I actually, in general, I tend to be the sort of lazy get it sent to me kind of guy. But I think so I went to a couple of recyclers at some point that were sort of in the local area. But I think the furthest that I've gone was it was I'm in Boston. It's somewhere in Pennsylvania that I went in response to a Craigslist ad, because there was a retired sort of like middle school teacher who had, when they converted over the computer lab, had taken the whole thing home, basically. You know, so everybody had moved to, you know, new Macs and things, and so he had a whole bunch of 2Es but the thing that actually caught my attention is he taught, I don't know exactly what the subject was, but he had a bunch of robotics equipment. So he had these, you know, a couple of little robotic arms that the Apple II could run, and a whole pile of Lego stuff. And, you know, so I'd been sort of on the lookout for that. So I actually, you know, rented a car and went. I was trying to get the Lego stuff, but he said, you know, only if you take these, like, six monitors and, you know, a dozen 2Es as well. So that was about 300 miles. So I think that's 500-ish kilometers there and then back. No, I got that wrong. Kilometers are longer, right? So maybe I did get that right. Anyway, whatever. It took 5 hours to go.
You can't actually convert between kilometers and miles.
That's right. You have to stop at refrigerators in between.
Exactly. Can't go directly from one to the other.
But anyway, yeah, so that was a... And, you know, so now I did get a bunch of cool, you know, robotic arms that I still need to try, but... That's
something a lot of people don't know about Paul, that he's got some cool robotic arms. Never fight with Paul.
Yeah. Oh, well, it seems that a bit of a variety there. And just one final on that topic. Now, I won't say Australia lacks retro computing history. It's just that Europe and the US seem to have most of the good stuff. Now, I end up with shipping a lot of my acquisitions down to Sydney. And I'm just wondering, you guys in North America, do you get much stuff from overseas, or do you find that most of what you're looking for is at least on your continent?
I think for me, I have gotten a couple of kind of unusual things from overseas, but in general, I think most of the stuff has been local. There are a couple of people. There's a strange seller in Venezuela.
Oh, I was thinking of the same person. Yep.
Yeah, I've got a few of his box games, which I'm just waiting to rip the shrink wrap off.
As am I. Eventually one of us will open it up and find that it's just rocks inside there, and word will get out.
Although I think one trick about the getting shrink wrapped stuff from Venezuela is I think that you have to worry a little bit about customs, you know, because if they want to see what's inside, they will not respect the shrink wrapped.
Kind of expecting mine to have been carefully and skillfully opened up with a machete by customs, but no, it seems to have arrived intact, or at least they re-shrink wrapped it for me.
I've had lots of things I have acquired from overseas, from Europe, from Australia in particular as well. But usually, if I'm getting something from overseas, from Europe, it's going to be something like software or an accessory, because it's a pain to convert from PAL if it's something that has a video output, and it's sometimes a pain to convert the power requirements as well over to here in Canada. We use 120 volts. So because of that, I normally stick to something in North America if it requires power or has a video output. But for software, then, yeah, I go, being in Canada, I'm used to shipping everything up from the States anyway, so it's really no difference if I'm also getting software from the UK or deeper in Europe or Australia or what have you.
Now, I find the most frustrating part about getting things from the US particularly is they have a little thing on there, no international delivery or to the lower 48, and I'm going, well, you've just gone and lost your Alaskan and Hawaiian purchases. Yep. But
and what I've never understood, because it's so much more complicated if you're walking it to the post office. I don't understand why so many things that are on eBay in the U.S. will only ship to the U.S. I get it if they've been burned or there's particular countries where you say, you know what, if I ship it there, I'm going to get scammed. But if you're getting paid up front, how scammy could you get? But it's crazy how many American listings simply will not ship to Australia or Canada or Europe or what have you. I think it's people just don't think about it.
I can kind of speak to that, actually, having sold...
Answer for yourself there, Earl.
On eBay and putting in that specific proviso, and it was because of the horror stories that I'd heard...
About Canadians.
Not getting ripped off from the payment, because, of course, like you say, the payment is up front. but instead having terrible trouble with the transaction. Like the recipient gets the item and then they claim this isn't what I wanted, or you misrepresented the item, or in some other way saying, oh, it arrived broken and now you've got to take care of it. And of course, you're not going to have it shipped back. Maybe you are going to have it shipped back, but the shipping is really expensive because it's overseas. And I'd heard enough of those issues that I just thought, well, there's enough people in the 48 states, or actually just in the U.S. period, that want to buy this, it really, as a seller, didn't give me much more business opportunity to
sell. I think it's American xenophobia.
It is.
I mean, think about it. If you ship it from you to somebody in Louisiana and they have an issue, they will pack it up and ship it back to you because the shipping back comes at the buyer's expense. If you ship it to somebody in another country, like, they're going to pay the $30 to get it back in your hand so you can give them the $10 refund. It's safer to ship it to somebody else. What are they going to do about it? You're in another country, say, well, pack it up and get it back to me. When I receive it, then I'll give you your tiny little refund. I think it's all just Americans being mean.
But then they give you bad feedback, and they start to ruin your reputation.
I'm giving you bad feedback anyway. I'm going on eBay now and giving you bad feedback.
Well, you can't
hold you responsible personally, Earl, for all the bad things that have happened to me on eBay. And see why you shouldn't deal with Canadians. I guess that you were right after all.
I get on there, and I'm like negative 120.
128. Ah. I would definitely do a power of two.
Good.
Oh, that's good. No, that's basically why I started using a transshipping company. So I now get anything that I buy in the US, I get it shipped, and then I just have it mailed on or freighted on from there.
I do
and
the same
thing.
The
best part about it is they take photographs of the package as it comes in and the contents. So I even know that the objects or whatever have arrived intact at the warehouse, then I can decide whether I'm going to consolidate or just have the package taped back up and sent on to me. And normally at a lot cheaper shipping rates than what many people put on with their eBay listings. So. No, I save a lot of money.
Yeah, I agree, and especially because a lot of Americans, it's a good tip for people who want to buy outside of the U.S. because many listings will offer free shipping within the U.S., but they will charge full price. They don't give you like then a discount to say, hey, it would have been $10 to ship in America. Yeah. They don't knock the $10 off if you're shipping outside of America. So you can still take advantage of that initial free shipping and then just consolidate your items and do the same thing. And they'll put it in a nice solid container and then ship it off from there. You save a lot of money.
And the shipping that they normally choose is the most expensive overnight priority courier that you wouldn't have chosen anyway. So. But yes, it's not just my retro computer things that I do this way. If there's any hardware or other specialist items from North American retailers, I just get it sent to my transshipping address, pay for it either directly or via PayPal, and it all arrives nicely. Mind you, I did have one interesting one. The seller agreed to send the item to my address. He kept wanting to reject my bids because I was based in Australia. And then I won the auction, and then it came down and my payment was refused because I wasn't using a US credit card. I was paying in US dollars, but the actual transaction was refused because it wasn't being drawn on a US bank. And I thought, okay. I don't need that 300 baud modem as much as I thought I did.
No one needs a 300 baud modem that well.
It was supposedly a new inbox shrink wrapped, and I thought, what the heck? Something else to strip the shrink wrap off, but no, I let that one go, and then just had to fight with eBay on the non-payment issue, trying to explain to them, but I want to pay. He won't let me. Oh, okay. The fun and games of purchasing our retro acquisitions. I'm sure it'll pop up again, interesting stories. So, another interesting story, Carrington, Computer Lib Dream Machines.
So, this is a book by Ted Nelson. Now, people who are not old like me might not know who Ted Nelson is, but he was an information technology pioneer back when you could have things like information technology pioneers. He's the guy who came up with the word hypertext. So, like, he's actually, you know, there's a few words that he coined, one of which was hypertext and the idea of hypermedia. Both of them come from him. So he wrote a book, two books, really, but they were published as a combined thing in the early 1970s, 1974, as Computer Lib/Dream Machines. Dream Machines was an earlier work, and Computer Lib is the one that sort of turned me on to a lot of ideas that when I read it quite a few years after it was published. So the lib here stands for liberation. So it's computer lib, like woman's lib, not like library. Modern people, I think, will look at this and think, well, why have they abbreviated the word computer library? They haven't. It's lib. And even the cover of the book is fun because it's one of those raised fist covers. So it's a picture of a raised fist, like, let's go. And so what Ted was doing in this book, which is really a manifesto, was railing against some issues in technology that he was quite upset about, including the idea that computers would be locked off in one big room and people with the lab coats could get access and the general public couldn't. And he was very upset about that kind of setup. And it was a manifesto sort of preaching on, saying, no, people have to be able to control their own computers and not just have them on your desk, but be able to fully understand them, because a computer unlocks freedom and power. And if you don't want other people in the world to have power over you, you have to be computer literate. And computer literate is more than just, I know how to turn it on and use a word processor. Even at the time, he wasn't even saying you could do that, but just be able to enter your punch cards or just type up an address book. You have to be able to understand your computer, how to network it, how to connect to other people, how to use it as a force, like as a force for political power, a force for getting a better job, a force for freedom. It's that sort of language. So it's a really interesting and exciting book. And it's been something that I haven't been able to see, or it doesn't seem to be around at all. And then recently on Reddit, of all places, somebody says, hey, I just stumbled across a couple of PDFs of the old Computer Lib/Dream Machine books. I'm going to upload them to archive.org so everyone can get access. And I got quite excited about that, grabbed the link, throw in our show notes, and I'm just doing my best to pass it on. So it's the kind of thing that if you weren't around and interested in computers in the late 70s and have sort of come back to it by retrocomputing, it might seem kind of weird. And his fight with the down with cyber crud is what he called all that nonsense, keeping people away from computers. It might seem an angry book, like it might seem, and coming from a strange mentality. But it was a very inspirational and I think a very important tome at the time. And it's coming from a time where there were things like the Whole Earth Catalog, and the idea of computers was a polarizing and political thing. And a lot of that has been lost now as the dust has sort of settled and decisions have been made, and the relationship between people and computers and networks and people and such has all sort of now played out. But this is back from a time when it was still an ongoing fight and decisions were still being made. So I think it's an important document, and I'm really happy it's now on archive.org. And I suggest that people are interested, if any of the angry language I have used has sparked an interest, it's definitely something worth reading. So it was published as a dual book, and how it worked was the first half of the book was like in one orientation, and the rest was, it was a book where you would turn it around and read from the back cover upside down to read the second book. So it was two books published as one book, sort of combined, which is why it has such a weird sort of cover. So yeah, so Computer Lib by Ted Nelson is now on archive.org. We'll have a link in the show notes.
That's worth looking at. Mm-hmm. That whole era, as you mentioned, where the fighting against the man and the big business, big government that is trying to keep us down. I mean, it still goes on today with people and the NSA and spying on us and stuff like that. But it was just their version of it back then, about this no-fold, spindle, and mutilate generation.
Mm-hmm. And Ted Nelson is an interesting guy.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you enjoy reading the book, you should definitely check out, I think it's on YouTube, the video segment of Ted Nelson at the Homebrew Computer Club reunion, because he gives a very interesting presentation there. And it's true that we may not have the same sort of issues that we had then, but today we've got DRM versus free media. We've got walled gardens versus open architectures. We've got open source versus closed source. There's still a lot of, I guess you could call them computo-political issues that we're dealing with that are reminiscent of that. And computer lib was incredibly important and what's the word that I'm looking for? I guess inspirational for a lot of people.
Influential.
Mm-hmm. And influential.
It was for me. I read it as a still relatively young, relatively impressional person. And it had a big impact on me, more so than I think I even thought at the time. But it definitely shaped a lot of ideas and a lot of opinions that I held for quite a few years, some of which I still hold. So Ted Nelson is a really influential guy and just, you know, has had a big impact, a much, much larger impact than people will think. When people think about who out there has shaped technology, they think about Steve Jobs, they think about Bill Gates, but you don't necessarily think about, like, information technology philosophizer like Mr. Nelson. But he was a super influential guy who steered a lot of tides, and this is, I think, probably his most important book, so it's well worth reading.
I'll definitely have to read the PDF. Mm-hmm. I remember reading it back at university, but it's actually a book that I don't have in my library, so I think I'll have to add it to my get list as well.
Yeah, I don't have a copy either.
Well, it was kind of unobtainium, but I think that fairly recently Ted Nelson started selling an updated version of the
really?
Book.
Okay. Oh, see, I would love that. Oh, I didn't know that was the case. Nice.
I'll have to go on a bit of a search.
Mm-hmm, me too.
Yeah. Paul, you've got a bit of information about a pre-release, pre-premiere.
Yeah, so there's in the fairly recent past, there's been a fair amount of publicity about this show that the channel AMC is going to have. So they're the same channel. I forget now what they've had a lot of things, Mad Men and I think Walking Dead, and these are, you know, like various shows that are well regarded and famous. But they're about to start in a week. They're going to start a show called Halt and Catch Fire. Which is a drama that's basically about the sort of, I think it's set in 1981, and it's basically just essentially a company that is, it's about a fictional company essentially reverse engineering the IBM PC to make a clone. And, you know, so it's pretty interesting in its focus on the time, and, you know, they've got the actual 5150 there open, you know, and so they... One of the things that's also, you know, made a fair amount of publicity on this is that even prior to the release date, the premiere date, which is June 1st, in a week from when we're recording this, they made the episode available. Well, I think there are a couple different ways that it is available. They definitely made it available on their own site, so as I understand it, it's region locked. On the AMC TV.com site, but there is at least what looks to be a legitimate YouTube version of this that is not region locked, so you can see it outside the US. But so it's supposed to be a drama, you know, it's supposed to be not exactly about technology, but yet it is right in this world that we think of that we're talking about now, and so it's going to be, I think, quite interesting to see what effect this has, because I know they want this to be a sort of like large, wide audience, you know, big scale, you know, Mad Men sized success with people. So perhaps we'll see more people, you know, coming to the vintage computer hobby as they are reminded of this. And I should also mention that Terry Stewart emailed to suggest this as a thing to mention, and I think he watched the first episode also. I have watched it, and it's not something for the kids, but it looks pretty good. You know, I think there are a few things. One might imagine that it's not entirely historically accurate, even given that it's fictional. There's an extended scene where they're trying to kind of like figure out what the contents of the proprietary BIOS chip is. And this is done by desoldering a bunch of stuff and like putting a bunch of what look like kind of modern LEDs on a breadboard and spending 8 hours reading, hex in writing it down on a piece of paper when of course there was an easier way to do that, and they would have known it. But so far I have been fairly impressed with the, sort of unobtrusive, but still fairly, legitimate, correct characterization of things.
So do they in that first episode, explain to those who don't know what the Halt and Catch Fire reference means?
Oh yeah, HCF,
baby. Yep.
Yeah, they, right at the beginning, it's basically a title card kind of thing that they put up at the front that says, and I forget even what they say, but it says something like it's an instruction that would cause a race condition that no one was in control or some sort of thing. I think it's Wikipedia that has a definition of this, which I like better, which is essentially, I think, that it was supposed to be, the idea was that it was an instruction that would essentially kind of like jump to itself or something, and so it would cause a certain memory location to be accessed so often that it would just get hot, so the computer would hang and you couldn't get it to do anything, and it would then catch fire.
But it could be from that. I remember the computer class in college in 75, they had a set of opcodes for the computer that were like not real, and they're all three-letter opcodes, like HCF was the Halt and Catch Fire, and they had several others like that that were humorous, impossible, wouldn't happen things, and that was just one of them I recall. Mm-hmm.
That's what I remember as well, and that it was always the story that the basis was old magnetic core machines, because you'd be accessing actual wires and things, and because if you kept hitting the same locations over and over again, the wires would actually heat up and start to smoke. Though that was always just sort of the story, that's where this idea came from, but even at the time, it was obviously apocryphal, like sure, that was the case. But I remember it from back in the day as, HCF being a thing.
But your question about have anybody watched it? I myself haven't watched it. I'd forgotten this was coming, and now I've got myself signed up on the AMC Show Watcher thing, so I'll be remembering to set it for my DVR.
I'm super excited about this. I, for some reason, was completely oblivious to this at all and have now learned about it because of our show notes. Doesn't matter that people write into the show. I'm still unaware of it. And I'm really excited. I think... I can't believe this is going to be a thing. I don't know how there's an audience for this outside of our listeners, but whatever. This sounds fantastic to me. I love the setting of this show just makes me excited. I don't care what it's actually about. I'm definitely going to watch it.
Yeah, I definitely think I'll have to see if I can stream it, but it's going to be difficult. I can't really see it being a big audience down here in Australia, but maybe I'll have to get my VPN and everything set up again to stream it down here.
So I watched it. Oh, and yeah, I did. And I enjoyed the first episode. I agree with Paul that it's not family friendly. It starts right off with a gratuitous scene, I think, but at least that sort of maps into how the story flows. And it is interesting that it's set around this idea of reverse engineering the BIOS and creating a PC clone, but I get the impression that they're going to try and promote the drama of it, the people stories, and they'll just revolve around the technology per se. So it's an interesting setting. And I thought the acting was good. The production quality was pretty good. So overall, I wouldn't be surprised to see it succeed.
It's also kind of neat to see Ned from Pushing Daisies back on TV.
I liked Pushing Daisies
a lot.
That
was a good show. Had nothing to do with retro computers, but...
Doesn't matter. I loved it. I'm a big softy romantic, and I loved everything about Pushing Daisies.
And it had an interesting quote that goes back to something Carrington was saying earlier.
Yes, let's bring back things that Carrington said.
Yeah, so the quote was, the salesman guy says, "Computers aren't the thing. They're the thing that gets you to the thing." And that's kind of like what you were saying earlier, Carrington, that the power in computing of it will let you get a job, or it'll let you connect with other people on a social level, or it will get you information that you need to succeed.
Yeah, so liberation. Rise up, my nerdy brothers.
Exactly. Power to the people.
Yes. The wimpiest, palest liberating army ever.
Yes, we'll make sure we come out at night. Otherwise, it's just that sun's just going to ruin our pasty complexions.
It's too bright. It's too bright, and especially down there where the ozone's thinner. You know, it's you don't need any of that.
No. Well, continuing the rage, I found this article interesting about Bletchley Park and the National Museum of Computing. I actually thought that they were one and the same, but
mm-hmm. Me too.
No, it seems not. So there's a little bit, if the article in The Guardian is to be believed, a little bit of angst going on at Bletchley Park. So they've secured an £8 million grant back in 2011, which they've used to restore a lot of Bletchley Park, and it's now bringing in the crowds. We'll stick with the idea of crowds, but it's also opened with some 6-foot fences separating the two museums, each of which is claiming that they are the legacy of Bletchley. So you've got the National Museum of Computing, where we've got Colossus and the wartime history. And then you've got Bletchley Park, who are obviously concentrating on the actual buildings and grounds as the historical location. So when you get your ticket to enter Bletchley Park, I believe that's about £15, it doesn't get you entry in to see the Colossus display or any of the rest of the National Museum.
Which I'm sure surprises a lot of people. It would surprise me.
Oh, surprise would be a very polite word for me. And I thought, well, why don't they have a combined ticket? And then I scrolled down the article a bit further, and basically someone thought, yes, let's have a combined ticket to get in. But no, could they sort themselves out to that? No, of course not. So I'm really hoping they can get this sorted out, because, okay, if I get over there, I'm going to go see them both anyway, and I will grumble and fork over my extra £5 to get into the museum part, which in all honesty is the bit that I really want to see anyway. As much as I love looking at old buildings and beautifully maintained grounds, it's the tech that I'm after, and Colossus is Colossus. It's a very historical computer, and in retro computing sense, it's only really come onto the scene in the last decade, because it had been slapped down with so many top secret classifications that no, it's really only just starting to emerge exactly what was being done in Bletchley Park. And to me, Bletchley Park could just be another nice little estate somewhere in merry old England. And really, guys, get together, a little bit of rapport. Sort it out.
Yes, indeed. I'd read a while back that there were some issues going on there, a little bit of dirt getting kicked on people's shoes, and I just thought, wow, this ought to be something that you can sort out so that you can both mutually succeed and both things are important. And yeah, you know, it doesn't sound like something that is an intractable problem. They ought to be able to fix it.
I'm with Michael, though. I never knew that these were different things. We have talked about, in fact, I have talked about multiple events and things that have happened at Bletchley Park and at the National Museum of Computing, and I have discussed them interchangeably since the beginning of this podcast. I never knew until today that they were actually different things run by different trusts, just happened to be at the same location. That was completely news to me. And like Michael, if I went there, the reason I would be going would be to see the historical technology, and being very happy to see it in its historical context. So I want the grounds, I want the buildings, that's awesome. But for me, the £15, what the purpose is to see the tech. So if I had to choose between one of the two, I just want to enter the grounds so I can get to the museum. So I wouldn't be resenting the £5 I paid to see Colossus and the tech there. I'd be resenting the £15 I had to pay to get access to the path that lets me get to the door so I can pay my £5. So I too hope it will be sorted out. The people in the article talk about how both trusts have as a greater goal, sort of the same ideals. So it should be able to be sorted out. But I'm just sort of disappointed. I'm disappointed that this is the case, and I totally understand why people who show up there might be, like as Michael said, politely putting it, as disappointed that they get hit with a second fee to enter what I would consider the main reason to be there.
Yeah, well, it's now an extra £2 or £5, but that's per head. So if you're there
and you have two or three heads,
yeah, well, Zaphod, that's your problem. Okay. That's my raging against the institution. So let's just see. So Steve, I hear that you've heard a new podcast is on the scene.
Yes, well, and of course this is Paul's baby too. But
is it our Paul?
It is.
He's cheating on us.
He's seeing someone else on the side. I don't know.
Well, our co-host for RCR and Carrington's co-host for No Quarter have started a podcast about the Apple III with the amazing name Drop 3 Inches.
So I'm being cheated on twice.
Exactly.
Just saying.
And as a person who has a special interest in the 8-bit history of Apple and its products and things that were orphaned by Apple and so on, I found it really interesting to listen to this initial episode, hearing some of the stuff I know about, hearing a couple things I didn't know about. For those who don't know it, the Drop 3 Inches title comes from the early days of the Apple III when they had some parts in there that would get loose, a board that would get loose when it would heat up, and a solution that was proposed that I thought was kind of apocryphal until some other piece of information popped up, was to actually lift it up and drop it 3 or 4 inches, and that would seat it back in place and it would start working again. And on Facebook, the Apple III group on Facebook, the guy who used to work at Apple who actually recommended that fix made a post and said, "Hey, that was me. I'm the one that came up with that."
That was mind-blowing.
This sounds interesting. So yeah, perhaps we should get one of the co-hosts onto the show to talk about it. Hey, Paul.
Yes, and here he is. Yes.
Excellent. Yeah, no, it's I'm really looking forward to doing this. I think it for one thing, it's kind of an excuse to actually start using the Apple III I have been sort of like learning a lot about it and collecting, you know, bits and pieces relating to it. But and I brought an Apple III without its case to Kansas Fest last year. Perhaps I will do that again. But yeah,
but no, honestly, Paul, what does Mike McGinnis know about an Apple III anyway?
he perhaps is the leading expert, I think, on sort of like the history
on planet Earth.
Exactly. Yeah. I intend to learn a lot from this experience. But we've put one out. We've recorded another one, and I think we're aiming for something like every 2 or 3 weeks having a new one.
Who does the editing?
Mike has been doing the editing, but I think we'll probably end up sharing that.
I'm going to say 2 or 3 weeks is quick.
Now.
I work with him.
Yes, but
editing is hard work. Editing is hard work.
And of course, this show pretty much goes out as recorded. This one, so
all my shows go out as recorded if I'm the editor. That is the secret sauce to my podcast.
Yeah. No, I think it's great that the Apple III is getting its own podcast. Mm-hmm. It is really the forgotten part of the Apple. Everyone seems to be aware of the Apple II. Everyone's aware of the Macintoshes. And no, the Apple III has kind of been pushed into the back room of computing. So I'm looking forward to listening. So congratulations to Paul and Mike on getting that show out on the air. And
first episode's really good.
Yeah. And listeners, if you're interested in the Apple III, pop over to iTunes or pop over to the website and have a look, have a listen. I think you'll find it a different computer to the rest of what Apple has put out. So, Carrington,
yeah.
Why does George R.R. Martin still use DOS?
Because then he can only kill 8.3 characters at a time. No, it's because he hates word processors that have spell checkers. Honestly, I'm not making that up. So there's a really, well, I found really interesting little note on the BBC. So bbc.com, we will link to it. Where in an interview, he happened to mention that he still uses, to this day, WordStar 4.0 on a DOS computer as his word processing system. That's what he is writing the current, you know, Game of Thrones novels on. That's what he has always written with for the last 20 years or so, and what he will continue to work on. He's kind of curmudgeonly that way. And he says, in particular, as a fantasy author, he uses so many words, not just names, but just so many words that spell checkers are just going to say, what? Come on. That it just becomes more of a hassle to have more technology in your word processor. So I found it really interesting.
A mass of squiggly red lines.
Exactly. Just all red all the way. So that's what he uses. And so I found the fact that he uses that interesting. And I also enjoyed the short write-up on the BBC because of the things that now in a modern news story they feel they have to include. And it really jumped out at me because he talks about how he uses DOS. And if you scroll to the bottom of this, it says things like disk operating system computers were popular in the 1980s and early 1990s. And it's funny how that's the kind of thing that has to now be included as a historical note in a news story, as if like that wouldn't be something people would just know. So I found that
setting the context.
Yes, yeah. And I like the fact that they don't call it DOS computers. It's disk operating systems computers. Like, so I just love the way the BBC writes, and so I dug it. I dug the story. I like the fact that I love people using old stuff for modern things. So I dig it, and I wish him well, and I wish him lots of backups in particular, because I worry, because I have personally been waiting for the next Game of Thrones novel for quite some time. So the whining of the people that are waiting for the TV show just fall on deaf ears when it comes to me, because winter has been coming for 16 years. But I liked the fact that he's still using that, and it makes me, I find it charming and wonderful, and I like that they call it disk operating system computers.
Of course, if he simply knew how to shut off the spell check settings on his word processor, you know, then he could use a modern operating system and have backups and all that kind of cool stuff too. So there are ways of doing what he wants to do without having to go back to a text screen.
A DOS emulator, for instance.
That's right.
Absolutely. Yeah. For all we know, he is using one, and somebody behind the scenes has just said, look, just do it full screen. He'll never know, but we have backups. Hopefully his publisher's on this.
I thought WordStar 4.0 was kind of buggy. If I were him, I think I'd be using 3.3, but that's just me.
Yeah, I can understand why he's using that style. I know a couple of guys who are into the writing, and they basically aren't quite as retro as what he's doing, but they use applications on their modern computers to minimize the clutter on the screen. Again, there's no editing tags for grammar and for the spelling. So, yes, there are ways around it, and that gives you your version control and everything in these packages. But if he finds his creativity works best with DOS, then let him create more characters so they can meet untimely demises.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Creativity works best with DOS. That's a phrase. Yes. That's an unusual sounding phrase to me.
It is. So, untimely demise. So, Earl, you want to talk about the untimely demise of capacitors?
I do. And we know that capacitors are a failure point on our poor old retro computers. And aside from sending us links to premieres of new television shows, Tezza also does a lot of repair work. And he doesn't just do the repair work, but he kindly documents it and takes pictures and such for the rest of us so that we can either learn from him and do the same thing, or we can just, as I do, sit on the sidelines and kind of ooh and ah and bow in respect. And taking a look at his blog is really interesting and informative. I want to push people over there again, if you haven't seen it, classic-computers.org.nz. In this particular entry that we'll have a link for in the show notes, he replaces the capacitors in his classic Mac. They were failing, and now they're not failing. So once again, Tez wields the mighty soldering iron and makes us all, I don't know what we do. We look on in awe and respect. Don't
definitely,
we?
Definitely. I love it because his write-ups, when he does something like this, it's like there's lots of modern sites for, say, if you want to upgrade the hard drive in your computer, and there's lots of, and it's like he's doing a version of those, like, you know, ifixit.com, but for the Classic 2 in this case.
Yeah.
And so I love it.
Yeah.
Like, here's where you open up. This is what the board will look like. These are the bits you solder. And here's what it looks like when it's working again. I'm like, I love it.
Yeah. And he's doing it for the surface mounted capacitor. So I do like how he's showing his destruction method for removing the capacitors with the side cutters and the long nose pliers, and then fixing up the pads and how to put a more traditional capacitor in there. And the good thing is that there are hints that they can be carried back onto the older machines on the prep of the board, the cleaning up of the capacitor goo. It is a very well laid out blog entry on getting in there, reminding people to sort of like not only to replace the capacitors, but just to check clearances for other cards and closing up the machine so that that it's all going to fit back together nicely and then hopefully work when you power up. So I quite enjoyed browsing through that blog entry, and that one's definitely being put into my retro bookmarks because I've got a couple of machines which I think are starting to exhibit problems from leaky capacitors. So some more projects on the to-do list. So it looks like I'm going to be a busy boy for the next couple of decades.
And it's not necessarily that these capacitors he's replacing are themselves more better capacitors than the old ones. They're just new, and if he uses computer for another 20 years, he may have to replace these too.
Yeah, it seems to be a bit of a weak part in the design, but we need them. Replace them.
I think that's not entirely true. Actually, I think this particular era of capacitors is bad. Pretty much every Mac. If your Mac of this era still works, it's not going to much longer. they pretty much all need to be replaced. Then they're all going to fail.
Yeah.
So
basically, there was a big problem with capacitors back then. Just as Sony had a very bad run of the lithium-ion batteries that they were manufacturing for. Many laptop manufacturers, Apple, Lenovo, a lot of them were having that embarrassing moment when your laptop explodes.
Yes, it starts to swell.
I just
angry like
that.
The Hulk.
Awkward.
I've sort of found a bit incredulous with it until I actually saw someone's laptop where the battery had swollen.
Mm-hmm. I've seen many of them.
And it had happened so fast that it actually ended up locking the battery in place. They couldn't get the cover off, and then it just basically distorted the machine and cracked the motherboard. So, the battery died, and it took my computer with it.
Yeah, my wife's MacBook had that happen, actually, although we were able to get the battery out. But, yeah, it started to swell up. It started to make the whole computer hot, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm. My sister's MacBook had the exact same problem, or MacBook Pro. 15-inch MacBook Pro had the same problem with one battery.
But, you know, these weak points, another thing that Tez's blog had helped me on, I had a 386 motherboard, and onboard was a Dallas DS1287 real-time clock chip. And the thing is, it's not just a chip. It's a whole package that includes a battery and the silicon for the real-time clock circuitry. And once it goes bad, then your motherboard CMOS settings won't stay anymore. And so you're kind of up a creek unless you, and I'm amazed about this, and you can actually look at this on his blog, and I did it, so I can tell you it works. You can take a file and you can file into the side of the substrate of this chip, disconnect the built-in battery, solder on an external battery, and have your clock chip live again. Now, who would think about something like that? But you find out stuff like that on blogs like Tez's. So I actually did it, and it made my 386 motherboard live again. So there you go.
Yeah, it's probably it's actually quite a bit cooler than, you know, spending $3 to get a new chip.
Well, and they don't make like a, I think an upwardly compatible, but if you were to buy a DS1287 today, would you be getting new old stock? And if you were, then the battery's probably dead in that too. So this was a solution like the capacitors that you were mentioning, Paul, the better technology today that will probably last into the future as opposed to just having to be fixed again tomorrow or the next day.
Yeah, okay. Well, Steve, you wanted to revisit DRM?
Well, yeah, I had the inability to attend with the last show and listening to the conversation about that. And I guess I want to pose another point of view about copyright and patents and DRM just to have it out there, because I know Carrington is of the vine that it's all bad, don't ever do it.
Yep, but big socialist.
What I would like to propose would be probably the better compromise would be if they could make copyright dates, copyright limits, patent limits have a lifespan that's reasonable, you know, especially for software, you know, 5-10 year lifespan, and then have it expire and have it just go, you know, public. And I'm thinking in terms of if I was a software producer in 1981 and I came up with a great game and I wanted to release it, I could understand why they'd say, but if I put it out there, you know, 100,000 high school kids are going to copy this and give it away, and I'm going to sell, you know, 50 copies. I just spent, you know, this, and this is not just my sideline. This is not something I do with my spare time. This is, I'm trying to get out of working at the fast food place and have this be my career because I love programming, I'm going to say. So it'd be nice to have some way of saying, okay, copyright on this is valid, and a DRM, whatever, is valid for this much time, and then it expires and it unlocks. That could probably be done, but to have something, have everything unlocked, I think makes it so that some people who are looking at this as being something they could use to earn their living with are going to say, well, there's no way I can earn a living with this if I have to give it away.
So after we had that episode, I talked to my wife, and you know, we were both trying to brainstorm the alternate universe in which there was no protection of intellectual property, no copyrights, no patents, never had been. And it was interesting to think through all of the changes that that would make, both good and bad. I think it's an interesting philosophical exercise. I don't think it's ever going to happen.
Other than when it did happen, 14th to 17th century Italy. But
well, I kind of go with Dr. Steve on this in that I think, you know, first off, it'd be kind of problematic to say we're not going to do it anymore in that it's actually a part of the United States Constitution, not just something that Congress legislated, but actually part of the Constitution of the U.S. So might be
copyright.
Difficult to
copyright
yeah.
in there.
Yeah, yeah. The protection of intellectual property for a monopoly for a limited time to promote the sciences and useful arts.
And there's the problem, definition of limited. Mm.
And limited, according to the founders, you know, what we call the founders, those dudes who wrote the Constitution, did not mean the lifetime of the artist plus 95 years. They would be rolling over in their graves or their urns or whatever if they knew how we had strangled that today. Mm. I firmly believe that they would come back and, you know, go all vampire hunter on us.
See, I think it was two separate issues, though. DRM and copyright are totally different things.
Mm. Oh, they
the idea of having a copyright law, I'm not against. And the idea of saying, and if the idea is we're going to give a limited term monopoly for the promotion of the arts, we first have to accept that having the monopoly would promote the arts. I don't agree. But if we do, then fine. We say, you know, you get your 10, 20, 25, 50 years, whatever it is. But that's separate from saying we're going to have DRM, which
we're going to have now companies enforcing the law themselves and in a way that cannot be removed, and we're going to implement new laws that make it illegal for people to get around the DRM even once copyright's expired.
See that's the problem area right there, to make it illegal for me, strictly speaking, for me to go back and do boot tracing on a copy of a disc that I own from 1982 so I can make it work on, you know, today. Because I don't know how to defeat the copy protection. Strictly speaking, if somebody wanted to, they could prosecute me on that. Yeah, and just and you will. Carrington's going to make sure.
Actually, I believe that there are exceptions in the DMCA for archival purposes.
But you have to go to – it's like with a lot of stuff like this. You go to court and prove it. So it's Disney on the one side and you on the other. And
no, I'm not defending anything crazy like the DMCA. I personally –
then you shouldn't have written
on record. I hate it. But – but, you know, I will say that they at least had some level of brains to make a provision for the kind of thing that Dr. Steve's talking about there. I don't understand why they do it. As a, for instance, I think it was the Electronic Communications Privacy Act back in the mid-80s that made it illegal to listen to cellular phone conversations. And at the time, I thought, well, that's just nuts. What that's going to mean is that if you happen to even know that such a law exists and you're a law-abiding citizen, then you're not going to listen to those cellular phone conversations. If you're anybody else, either you don't know the law is there or you just don't care who's going to know that you're listening to something, then you're going to listen to it. It didn't actually make cellular phone conversations any more private. All it did was allow them to bill it, you know, from a marketing perspective, like, oh, these are private now because it's illegal.
But also, I guess it gives another vector for prosecuting, which in the same thing DRM can do. So if you do go and set up a shop and you're distributing, you say, now I'm in the business of distributing copies of this movie or this software or what have you, it's another thing they can prosecute you for. So I think that's the real power of DRM. It doesn't
stop
anybody.
It was already illegal, though.
Yeah, but it's more illegal. It's extra illegal, and now they can kill you or whatever.
Yeah, that's the thing. Why don't we just do the firing squad?
It's America. I suspect that you do.
You know, you pirate a movie, kablam, you're done, buddy.
So, I'm not coming to Portland.
Murder is okay, but copyright infringement? No. Yeah, it's all crazy. It's all crazy. Can I sum it up, guys? It's just all crazy.
It is all crazy. I agree.
Hmm. Well, okay. I will take your craziness.
Raise you.
Yes. Born with Curiosity, the Grace Hopper documentary. Now, I wonder what DRM they'll apply to that. So if we go to Indiegogo, there is they're at $41,000 of their $45,000 goal to create a documentary on Grace Hopper. Now,
oh my gosh, we must make this happen.
I know. This is definitely about one of the forgotten, possibly pushed into the backroom stories. And I really hope that this goes ahead. We'll provide a link to Indiegogo. So if you're interested in Grace Hopper, and if you don't know who Grace Hopper is, then this movie definitely is for you. So, as they say, Steve Jobs had 8 films made about him and another in pre-production. But without Grace Hopper, Steve might have just been another door-to-door calculator salesman. So, yes, she had that kind of impact on computing. But really, outside of really a retro computing niche, she is a very unknown person. So, guys, who would be interested in watching a documentary about Grace Hopper?
Me too, and I have already contributed to the Indiegogo campaign.
Excellent.
Yeah, and it looks like it's getting pretty close. It's already, right now, it's at 41,000 out of 45,000.
Yep.
If you're listening to this podcast and it is before June 7th, 2014, press pause on your media player and go contribute right now.
Join us.
This has to happen. She was so incredibly important in the development of computing and quite a character. Have you guys ever seen any video presentation with Grace Hopper?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, you should YouTube that.
Oh, yeah. I'm thrilled about this documentary coming, and I'm particularly thrilled that it looks like it's going to get funded. I had worried it wouldn't, and now it looks like it will, and I'm delighted about that.
Well, isn't it with Indiegogo that the funds?
Yeah, they get the funds anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. So we were all going to say that.
Yeah. So basically, they've got a budget of around $135,000. They're seeking $45,000 to begin production. Being at $41,000, that's pretty close to that there. But really, as Earl said, hit pause now, go donate, come back, and then listen to us go on about how great she is. She is definitely someone that you need to know about in the history of computing.
Yeah, my concern wouldn't be that it wouldn't like reach its funding goal. It's more that if it shows no interest and they end up raising only $2,000, then the film just doesn't happen. Right? So I want not just it to make the $45,000, but I'm hoping lots of people contribute, even go and just contribute a little bit, because it's a way of saying, yeah, I want this to exist. So I would rather have 10 times the people each give 10 times less, same amount of money, but more groundswell of interest.
Oh, most definitely.
Introducing a computer that can change the way you work. The new Tandy 1000, complete with DeskMate software for easy-to-use word processing, filing, worksheets, scheduling, communication. Brought to you by Tandy, clearly superior for service, support, and software. The Tandy 1000, available at Radio Shack computer centers, and so affordable. Tandy technology, service, and support are clearly superior.
So, I think we've pretty much done a good snapshot of the news that's out there in the retro world. So, there are some computer events. We've got the Commodore 8-bit repair in Lucerne, Switzerland, June 18. We've got everyone's favorite Apple Fest, Kansas Fest, 22nd to 27th of July, coming up. There's the Living Computer Museum Computer Fair on August 9. Links to all of those if you're interested. And listeners, if you're involved or know about a computer event in your area, drop us a line and we'll make sure it goes into our show notes. We'll give you a shout out and we'll let people know that what you're up to. Okay, the part of the show that the hosts let it know what would be an ideal computing gift. Well,
what are we buying you?
You're buying me. Well, we've all seen them. Well, maybe you haven't, but with Vija coming home, how about your own Voyager space probe golden record cover replica? Now, I've got a link here to the eBay where this one's actually being sold. And when I went in just before the show, someone's actually gone in and bought it, so I am waiting with breathless anticipation to find out which one of you guys actually bought it for me, and it's on its way.
Not me, but I wish it was mine.
It's, yeah,
checks
it's
in the mail.
Checks in the mail? No, I don't want the check. I want the cover. Mm-hmm. I want my golden record. Okay, so it's just be something different. You can be a rock star and have a gold record up in the bar at home. But really, this would be the gold record that I want to have hanging over at my bar.
Definitely. So, yeah. This looks fantastic. I wish I owned this.
Yeah. And really, it's not that expensive for what it is. It's a pricey, but it's I could justify it. Okay. Well, let's have a look. What's happening out on eBay? Well, I'll start it off. Now, because I put into the host gift idea this eBay link, I thought, well, it's only fair that I actually don't use an eBay link for my auction idea. So, is your front door a little bit bare? Do you have somewhere at home just to put a small icon of your Apple II-ness? Well, over at Bonhams, there is an auction for some discreet, subtle Apple advertising. Yes, you can get 2 6-color Apple logos. Now, not just any logo, these are around 46 to 49 inches in size, so subtle. Carrington, go your halves.
Yeah, I want the one that's in better shape. I would love. I live in a condo, and it would be great. I would just put them in the hallway.
I tried to get a groundswell of. Did you see that tweet, Carrington? I tried to get a groundswell of people to support me in getting this for you, but I only got one or two.
I know.
Bites.
I was disappointed in our listeners.
No. Yeah, it's
cough
like,
up
come
the $15,000 and buy me a gift.
Show the love. Show
come
the
on,
love.
It's just $15,000 estimated.
No, I just thought, It's an Apple thing. I've got the little clingy stickers for going on the inside of the glass. Apple shove stickers left, right, and center into their products, and every now and again you see a cargo pass that's got an Apple logo on there, and yeah. But yeah, when it comes to Apple logos, I think this is the Apple logo. Yeah, it just screams I'm an Apple II aficionado.
Yep, the six color logo, definitely.
Yep. Okay. Okay.
No, sure I could just make one myself of that size for much, much less.
Oh, but it doesn't have any intrinsic value. It's just a knockoff.
I know, but it would be in better shape than this.
It's like a counterfeit Rolex.
Yeah. So, okay.
Was it mentioned? Maybe I missed it, but the thing that makes this special, of course, is that these were actually outside. Apple. Mm-hmm. These are actual Apple signs.
These were attached to an Apple building, but you only get the logo. You don't get the building.
No. Oh.
Never mind.
So,
that.
Carrington, I raise you two logos.
I'm going to start by matching you with one logo, much less expensive, and shipping from Australia. I can't believe you overlooked your local one. So Myra Berg, she's an artist, probably best known for making what she calls these quiet oboes. They are giant pickup sticks wrapped in yarn that you put on the wall. That sort of artist. So back in 1983, she made a wall art hanging rug, sort of, 1980s crochet style, of the six-color logo, and that actual one is on eBay at the moment as well. So lots of big six-color Apple logo stuff is on. So it has a bid, which it didn't the first time I looked, and so its opening is $3,000, and it's going to sell because somebody has coughed up a bid for the first $3,000. If you go and look at this auction, because you're interested in it, I will draw your attention to one of the photos that shows some big dude with a big stogie holding this up. I'm like, is that the seller? I don't understand that photo at all.
He actually looks like a friend of mine.
Yeah. Okay. So that would apparently be the Australian, I guess, selling this. I'm not sure. So, but this is a Myra Berg original, $3,000, 2 days left on it, and we'll see if it goes. But my actual auction pick, I'm going for something in Pennsylvania. Does not ship to Canada. Big meanies. Local pickup only, in fact. Also has a bid, opening bid of $3,600, and it's a Heathkit Hero 2000, which is one of those, robots. So it's one of the Heathkit robots that had the big arm on it that you could program to go out and reach and pinch things. So if you wanted a serious old-fashioned 80s-style programmable robot, then the Heathkit Hero 2000 might be on your list. They rarely come up for auction. One is now. Shipping out of Pennsylvania, and for just a little over $3,000, it could be yours. Very pricey.
Wow. Yeah. I would love to get one of the I forget what it's called, the Hero 1 or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think that there was an earlier model that I think it had more character to it.
The Hero 1 looks more like something that would be in a TV show, sort of, because the Hero 1 had that, not really a face, but had that front-facing little camera thingy on the top, and the bottom part flapped out to get and had more of a claw-like arm. I agree, the Hero 1 is the one that I would want, but it's hard to get hold of any of these things. So.
Yeah, this is cool. This is cool. I hadn't seen this one before.
Yeah, there's a good site called theoldrobots.com, which basically, if you're looking for what robots existed, so we can link to that. It just. For instance, I never knew there was a Hero Junior. Turns out there was, so we'll link to that one as well for your old robot perusing joy.
Okay, well, we definitely seem to have some deep pocket items here. Steve, do you have something which is just a touch more affordable for our listeners?
Well, this was, just looking for something interesting. My first exposure to computers in college in 1975-ish was on a small IBM mainframe, the 1130. And, of course, we used the punch cards, and they printed millions and millions of these punch cards over the years for computer programmers, and sadly, I didn't bother to save any of them that I used. But this guy found the rollers, the printing plates that were used to make the punch cards, and bought them when somebody was going to throw them away. A printing company, and I think it was Canada. Yeah, Control Data had done it under license from IBM. And he bought these things, and so he has one of these printing plates. It's a round roller that would just be used to roll the cards as they were being printed. It has no real intrinsic value other than just a cool conversation piece. And this is only $20. Well, $20
oh, nice.
And 79 cents. Buy it now.
Yep, six available.
And there's also a make an offer, I guess, if you don't think $20 is cheap enough.
Oh, look, and international shipping.
Yes. There you go. It actually gets around that whole international shipping thing we talked about before.
But what bugs me is it's $31 shipping. So this is something that was in Canada, has been moved to the States, and I got to pay 150% of the cost of the item to ship it back up to Canada. That probably is not going to stop me.
That's the American way.
American way is angry.
But
$18 to ship it to Australia.
What? Why is it cheaper to ship it to Australia than Canada?
Because we trust the Australians. We trust the Australians better than the Canadians. We're always expecting
stupid
them to invade
shipping.
Us.
It's because of my health care, isn't it?
That's it. That's just it.
This is very cool. I want it.
Well, nice. Click on the buy it now, Carrington. Go on.
I want it for cheaper shipping. I might
make an offer.
This.
Make an offer. Offer him $10.
No, I can transship it cheaper, I think. But yeah, this is really cool.
Oh, they did have six available. It looks like the RCR podcast has just bought them out.
Really? Are they gone?
No.
Oh, I was like, oh darn! I was actually considering that. It's that or that Bonhams, giant $15,000 logo. It'd be one of the two.
Which and that rug does ship international.
Excellent.
Okay. Earl, you've got a button.
I do. It might be one of the more expensive buttons, but have you guys ever worked in a data center where you had the big emergency off switch?
Yes.
Yes, that's really cool, right?
Well, that's it.
And it's
yes.
a button that... As you walk around the room, yeah, you make sure to kind of strategically avoid that corner of the room because you don't want to accidentally bonk the button and bring down the mainframe. So I thought this would be great because I could pull this button like all day long and maybe I could make it power off my Raspberry Pi just so it, has to do a disk check on reboot. But this was really cool. In fact, that it was actually for one of the AMDOL machines, and I worked on an AMDOL machine when I worked at Hughes Aircraft. So I thought that this was cool. It was affordable and just a interesting, kind of whimsical part of computer ephemera that if you worked in a data center back in the day, you probably saw one of these, and it probably had that fear effect on you, like, ooh, I don't ever want to get near that. So...
I have encountered these a number of times in data centers, and it's always struck me the difference between data center emergency buttons and warehouse emergency buttons. My family has owned printing plants and metal fabrication plants and stuff like that, and currently owns a big custom metal fab plant. And on that sort of equipment, when it's a shear that will take off your thumbs or a 30,000-pound crane and just all these things that brake presses and stuff, and it's danger – get these big red smack it buttons. You go up, you hit it, you push it in, it will stop your thumbs being cut off, which is like a very, very important thing. But in data centers, so like it's really important that we don't do this by accident. And they're always emergency pull buttons like this instead of a push button. So I always found it interesting that it's like, well, when it's going to be your thumbs, we're okay if you nudge it and accidentally turn off the machine. But if it's something as important as our data operating running, we want you to really pause and think about it and do a pull. So I like that it's an emergency pull button.
Well, mainframes don't tend to kill people unless they fall on you. So maybe there's that.
I think I was at the... I think the InfoAge Museum, March's exhibit at the InfoAge Museum has a cray of some description that has a big red, you know, halt button near the top. I think I'm pretty sure that was a push button, but my understanding is basically the thing would melt down, you know, if you didn't stop it in time.
Yeah. Well, Paul, you've got a TRS-80 model 4P listed. Tell me more.
Yeah. It's, this actually is okay. The listing here is for the TRS-80 model 4P portable computer. It's a kind of computer that I did not actually even know existed until quite recently. But it is, so you know, there's the TRS-80 line that went, you know, model 1, 2, 3. And 4, I think. But the 4P is actually a luggable version of the TRS-80.
Of portable.
Yes, right, exactly. But I'd been kind of interested in that kind of that part of, you know, the sort of earlier TRS-80s, except that the problem is they're huge. You know, like it's just, you know, if you want to get all the sort of like official, you know, the TV and the or the Model 3 that's, you know, all one unit, it's just a lot of space. So what's cool about the, because every auction pick I make is about something small or luggable, I think this is really quite cool, this Model 4P, which is basically a TRS-80 that is in a, like, you know, sewing machine type case. And this one is quite reasonable. It's the starting bid is at $20. It's at 4 days from when I'm recording this right now, so probably only a day or two left when you're hearing this. But it costs $39 to ship, and it does it ship? May not ship out of the U.S. But anyway,
yep.
it's
not to Canada.
Sorry, but
even
it's
though
very
it's
cheap,
in a city called London, we've got one of those too.
Yeah. Right. There's no evidence. So there's evidence that the light behind the power switch works, but there's no evidence of any other life. There's a contrast, brightness and contrast dials to the left of the screen, and it's quite possible that the seller just didn't know how to do anything with them. But if it stays cheap, this might be kind of a neat project. Even if the CRT doesn't work, you might be able to fix it. I'll get back to that later. But anyway, I thought this was an interesting thing to see, and this is cheaper than almost all of them that I have seen listed recently. So that was that. And then in the show notes, I have a link to yet another PX8.
Yes, and since Notebook Supplies, or the I think they're Star Technology, since that outfit in Colorado doesn't have the new in-box ones anymore, unfortunately, getting a used one on eBay is going to be the way you're going to get a PX8, it looks like, going forward. If you did happen to buy one of these, go to what are the Batteries Plus, and let them make a custom pack replacement for your Nikon.
You were mentioning that in a previous episode, right? Yeah.
Yeah, because they did a good job, did a very good job. They've done a couple for me. And also, if you go over into Notebook Supplies, you can find they indicate in this eBay auction that they don't have the AC adapter. One option would be to go over to Notebook Supplies and pick up a compatible adapter for $24.95.
Mm-hmm.
So, you might be able to find a cheaper 6-volt, 600 milliamp hour, or not milliamp hour, that doesn't make any sense, milliamp power supply.
Milli refrigerator.
Yeah, that's right. So you might be able to find a cheaper adapter, but if you want one that you know is compatible, then those guys over at Notebook Supplies have them.
Yeah, and otherwise, I think at least, you know, if this stays cheap or stays at the starting bid or near it, this is a pretty cheap one. As I recall, too, the PX8, you're not supposed to leave it plugged in like for an extended period of time. You plug it in and charge it up and then unplug it.
Well, you actually can leave it plugged in, but the trick is you don't want to unplug it and then re-plug it in. There's a timer. So when you plug it in, it starts charging for a period of time, and after the timer expires, it trickle charges. If you, at that point, unplug it and wait a couple minutes and plug it back in, it's going to go through a full charge cycle again. And eventually, you're just going to smoke your NiCad. And also, not running it all the way down, since NiCads have that memory effect. If you don't run it all the way down and then charge it back up and run it all the way down and exercise the battery, then you're also going to decrease the life of the battery. But that said, it's not that expensive if you kill your battery to go have them build you another battery.
Halt and catch fire.
Exactly. You just do the HCF. It's actually possible on this, I guess.
Nice.
Okay, well, that pretty much wraps up that side of things. So, guys, anything else happening in your worlds? Carrington?
Well, the only thing that I want to point out is when I was on Reddit, loving the fact that somebody found that book that I wanted to read, and we will throw in the show notes. It turns out that, yes, reprints of Computer Lib are available for something like $20 or something currently from a very, very old-fashioned looking website. So I will throw that link in the show notes. But another, in a previous episode, maybe even last episode, I had mentioned, I think it was the company that makes the player piano rolls was still using an Apple II in current production to actually attach to a machine and pump those things out. And somebody on Reddit recently also found another one currently in production. And so I'm thrilled when some old computer is still being used. So there is a self-storage place in the U.S. that still does their bookings and their time tracking and which lockers are available and which are not, using an old Apple II, an Apple IIe, and a truly vintage one because it's got the light-colored text on the keyboard. So it's like an 83 model or something. So it's a super early Apple II using what appears to be, because they've added photos, a 2C monitor, which is the smaller 12-inch black and white monitor. It looks like that's the one hooked up to it. And, of course, it has a full-on answering machine, old cassette one, right beside it. So this is a seriously old tech company, and I adore them for it. So we will have a link to that in the show notes, too.
Okay. Well, I'm doing my annual charity ride for the Multiple Sclerosis Association. So I'll include a link to the Sydney to Wollongong ride. I'll be doing the 90-kilometre ride 2nd of November, I believe. So I've just registered on Friday, and I've got my donation site set up. So if anyone is feeling generous, there's a link. I'll provide a link to there. And if you can spare a couple of dollars to help MS research, it'd be greatly appreciated. On the computer front, nothing much else is happening. So moved in the last of my bookcases. So I think I've got about nearly 180 feet of shelving for my books. So that's all filled up. And
180 feet of bookshelf space.
It's a lot of bookshelf space.
Yeah. I actually went through my paperback novel section and culled about 5 foot of novels, so donated those. Local library's having a book sale fair next month, so I knew that I'd accumulated some duplicate titles, so and there were some other books, which novels, which I'd were definitely in the read once category. So I now have about 4 or 5 foot of shelf space waiting for some new books. So I'll have to keep my eye out. But I've got quite a lot of 6 foot bookcases, other bookcases back to back, and I think I've got a lot of other storage things. I think I counted that I've got about 30 something drawers in various units for storing bits and pieces as well downstairs. So the 8-bit bunker is definitely taking shape.
My goodness, so, you have much more than I thought possible.
I love books. Nothing better than just going down, finding a book you've only read 2 or 3 dozen times and just taking it out and having another read. So, Steve, anything interesting happening in your end of the world?
Not a bit.
I'm
going to go mow the lawn after this.
You can pop round and borrow my ride-on mower and do mine for me, too. Earl, what's happening in Portland?
Well, just enjoying day two of the 3-day weekend. And also,
oh, yeah, it's a holiday for you guys.
Yeah, and nice. I'm feeling kind of relieved that every year I have to renew my CISSP security certification, which involves doing a lot of training and recording it up on their website. So I have just recently finished all of the continuing education units that I need for this cycle. I always procrastinate, which is kind of good and kind of bad. It's bad because I shouldn't procrastinate, but it's good because I wind up getting huge doses of information influx all at once, and so I have like a little mini self-improvement training period where this time around I found out some things about programming and Windows PowerShell, security, other stuff. It's just great. Anyway, all done with that. So now I can actually focus on a little bit of retro.
Oh, that's good. Well, procrastinate now, avoid the rush. So, Paul, we know that you've been having a new podcast out there, but is there anything else happening out in Paul land?
Well, I have mostly just things that have shown up in the mail that I want to play with. I've, for some reason, all of a sudden have kind of an influx of Radio Shack stuff. So the Model 4P portable thing that I gave as an eBay listing, I also just bought one. that's how I know that they exist. I saw this listing and actually the one I bought cost more than the one I gave the listing for, but whatever. Actually, I kind of like this because it's they came in a couple of different models, their versions, and the earliest version is black and white, and the later ones were green screen. And I have a black and white one, which is the earlier one, and I'm very happy that I do, because that's what I think of when I think of TRS-80.
You know, definitely.
I don't think of a green screen. So I've gotten it to the point where I can turn it on, but I don't have any discs. So I've been looking into there's a few flash memory kind of solutions that you can spend quite a bit on and attach to these. This particular model can take a hard drive or a flash equivalent, which is pretty cool. So that's one of the things I would like to play around with more. And another sort of weird thing that I got also in the Radio Shack world was the disk video interface for the Model 100 series, which is a weird thing. So the problem with this is I don't have the cable, and the cable apparently is just a disaster to try to create, because basically every other pin is flipped, so it's not an easy cable to make. But it basically just gives you like a big display and a disk drive for one of these little Model 100 things. So these are the things I will play with soon.
Have you looked over at Club 100 to see if maybe they have one of those cables? I mean, it might be really unlikely, because the disk video interface was kind of unobtainium to begin with, but. But I wonder if they have one of those.
Yeah, I did email the contact address to see. I have not yet heard back. But meanwhile, I sort of looked around on the Usenet posts and things in the past, and what I have determined is that it's, to the extent that it's common to have a disk video interface, it is also common not to have the cable, and apparently they are not fun to build, so. Yes, I am hoping that even if it costs a bit, that I can find one that's actually pre-made. Anyway, that's it.
Okay, well, I think that's pretty much it for this show. So thanks for coming along, everybody. You can find show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss this and other vintage computer topics at vintagecomputer.com at the Vintage Computer Forum. You can follow us on Twitter at RCR Podcast, and you can send us feedback at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are also a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net, and if you like this show, please do write us a review on iTunes. It will help other people find this podcast. So guys, until next time,
Retro Compute!